determinations here, we have a lot to tell each other.
For his turn, Nikos Dendias, the Greek foreign minister, accused Turkey of not abiding by the deal made in 2016 with the EU, adding Turkey should not try to teach Greece lessons.
What's happened during the press conference after the meeting between Turkish and Greek foreign ministers was very unfortunate, but this is the actual illustration of the relation between the two. Many believe that there is no chance for reaching a solution. Today, a meeting between Cyprus, Greece, Israel and the UAE will take place. However, Egypt won't participate in this meeting. Turkey won't hesitate to respond if the outcome of this meeting wasn't up to Ankara's expectations, and I don't think the response will only be verbal.
In 2020, Turkey showed goodwill by pulling its search vessel Eurotrace from Eastern Mediterranean in hope that dialogue between Ankara and Athens would reach a common ground. The conflict between Turkey and Greece is too profound to be solved in few meetings. Analysts believe the two must put those differences aside if they plan to reach a solution, or else the conflict will worsen. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
There is no letter to the protest to compel Pakistani government to expel French ambassador from the country. At the heart of current wave of angry protest is government's decision to shelve its 5 months old agreement with Tehreek-e-Labbaik Pakistan or TLP, a religious and political party, to expel the French ambassador to Islamabad. The repeated incidents of publications of blasphemous cartoons of Islam's Prophet Muhammad and official patronage of France to unending incident of blasphemy has once again triggered a mass unrest in Pakistan starting early this week. The security forces came down hard onto the protesters and managed to clear most of the highways they had occupied across Pakistan few days ago. Paris has advised all of its citizens to immediately leave Pakistan over security concern to their lives. Pakistan has restored services of major platforms on social media networks after temporarily suspending them to contain the violence. The religious group claims that over two dozens of its supporters were killed by security forces while hundreds of others were injured and arrested. The government says nearly 600 of its policemen were injured and four of them were killed in the clashes. Pakistan has described the current wave of violence as an act of terrorism and banned the TLP.
We tried our level best through dialogue to avoid crisis from getting aggravated. However, subsequently, we found that they had a dangerous plan to cause the unrest in Pakistan. After banning the TLP, we will soon petition with the Supreme Court as part of our legal formality to get the TLP dissolved.
Pakistan's major political parties have history of attacking security forces and key state-owned buildings, some of them at far greater scale than that of TLP. The frequent incidents of blasphemy in the West has led to make TLP as one of the leading political forces in Pakistan. It is a well-entrenched and enjoys street power, and on one of the occasions late last year, it attracted millions of people in the eastern city of Lahore. Therefore, analysts believe that the government's decision to ban TLP is most likely to backfire, given the fact that TLP has extensively exploited the most sensitive public issue linked with the honor of the Prophet of Islam. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
On the occasion of Palestinian Prisoners' Day that marks April 17th of each year, Palestinian Prisoners Committee in the Gaza Strip held a protest in front of the oldest prisoner's house, Diya al-Agha, who spent 29 years in Israeli jails. This protest aimed to express solidarity and support to all Palestinian prisoners who suffer in Israeli jails.
We hope Palestinian prisoners return home soon, and we wish there is a swap deal that can free all the Palestinian prisoners from Israeli jails. They are our heroes, and we are proud of them. My only dream is just to see my son Diya again.
Nowadays, there are around 4,400 Palestinian detainees inside Israeli prisons. Most of them are suffering from different kinds of policies that aims to break the Palestinian detainees' will. The main policies practiced against them nowadays is medical negligence. This policy practiced against them since the beginning of the Israeli occupation. This policy caused more than 70 Palestinian murders killed through these policies inside Israeli prisons.
As part of the series of events held to mark Palestinian Prisoners' Day, the Palestinian Legislative Council held a press conference to renew the vow to set all the prisoners free from the Israeli jails and follow the steps of resistance.
Palestinians will free all prisoners who sacrificed their lives. We are following the footsteps of the prisoners, and their freedom is one of our major priorities. Israeli occupation won't see peace as long as our prisoners are suffering from the Israeli policies inside the jails.
There are some thousands of Palestinians in Israeli jails, including women and children.
On the Palestinian Prisoners' Day, people here stress that the prisoners are the symbol of the Palestinian cause and their issue is a priority, as the resistance won't sit idle until all Palestinian prisoners are free. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Nearly all British troops will be withdrawn from Afghanistan following the US President Joe Biden's announcement that US forces would leave before this year's 20th anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks.
We went to Afghanistan because of a horrific attack that happened 20 years ago. That cannot explain why we should remain there in 2021.
Over 100,000 Afghan civilians, 454 British troops, and 2,488 American troops have been killed. It cost the British taxpayer over £37 billion and the US taxpayer a whopping $2.4 trillion. It's lasted longer than both world wars combined and ranks as the US's longest ever war. But what's actually been achieved? The Taliban, which they fought so hard to oust, are poised to return to power and control most of the country. Takfiri terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda are still present, and new groups like Daesh have emerged. Moreover, Afghanistan now accounts for 93% of the world's illicit heroin supply, with heroin production reaching its record levels in 2017. We spoke to Lindsay German, who was at the forefront of the British anti-war movement and one of the leading voices making the case against the UK joining the US's war effort in 2001.
We argued back in September 2001, which, as you say, is now 20 years ago, that this war in Afghanistan would not deal with terrorism, would not solve the problems that were highlighted by 9/11, but would bring increasing misery to the people of Afghanistan.
The Speaker of the Afghan Parliament, Mir Rahman Rahmani, has warned that the withdrawal of foreign forces in the current circumstances will lead to a civil war, with many arguing the incumbent government is simply not strong enough to maintain power.
Lots of people assume that when the troops go, this will be the beginning of the end, at least for the existing government, because it very much depended on outside support in order to keep going. So, yeah, this war, I think if you want to sum it up, this is 20 years. What were those 20 years for?
Afghanistan has earned itself the nickname the Graveyard of Empires due to the failure of empire after empire, nation after nation, to successfully occupy and pacify the people. Many will question why it took the US and the UK so long to accept the inevitable, that this was a war they simply could not win. Ahmed Cabello, London.
For European Muslim women, wearing a niqab is no easy decision, with Islamophobic hate at epidemic levels and face covering bans coming into force. Choosing to cover up can land a woman with hefty fines, abuse or physical harm.
With so much hostility aimed at the Islamic face veil, it is truly astonishing that any woman would continue to embrace the practice. Yet, despite these risks, many niqabis living in the West choose to continue to remain covered. This Ramadan, I decided to find out why.
V spoke to several Niqabi sisters, including Zainab from Switzerland, the most recent country to ban the Niqab.
For me, it's a worship service act for Allah. Nobody told me you have to wear the Niqab right now. It's my free decision. It's a protection for me, and it's a free decision for my own to wear the Niqab. It's a thing between me and Allah.
Critics claim the Niqab holds women back, but renowned author Naima B. Robert rebuked these claims.
I think that it is really a case of the media and those behind the media need that myth of the oppressed Muslim woman in order to justify their attitudes towards Muslims in general, their hostile attitudes. It's very easy to demonize Muslims. It's very easy to enact legislation, populist legislation against Muslims, and to stoke hatred of Muslims because, hey, everyone's going to jump on board with that. All the parties will converge and agree on this. But what about the real things that are happening in those societies, whether it's unemployment, whether it's depression, all of the issues that are actually destroying their societies? Women in niqab are not that thing. Women wearing niqab in Switzerland or Holland or France are not the problem in your society. And we're not the problem with regards to any of the external threats either. We're not the terrorists. We are not the sleeper cells. We're just not. That's the fact of it.
It's true that not all Muslims believe in wearing a niqab. However, the Niqabis warn that once Europe has finished with them, the hijab and other Islamic principles could be the new target. Robert Carter, London.
A tribunal in Burkina Faso has decided to open a trial against Blaise Compaoré. He is accused of having organized in 1987 the putsch against Thomas Sankara and his killing. Recent interrogations revealed that France was directly involved in the putsch and maybe more. Thomas Sankara, who was called the Che Guevara of Africa, led in the 80s a popular revolution in Burkina Faso that eradicated the famine in 4 years' time and made the country self-sufficient on food production. He also called all the African leaders to suspend the debt payment to the World Bank and the IMF. Months later, he was killed. Decades after the murder of Thomas Sankara, Burkinabe judges have interrogated former members of the murder commando like Gilbert Diendéré. Journalists had access to the minutes of the report. It reveals the presence of French personnel just after the assassination.
At least 4 or 5 testimonies of Burkinabe militaries declared that French persons were present the day after the assassination in order to clean things up. That means they eliminated telephone conversations that could accuse the coup leaders. That does not mean that France was directly involved in the assassination of Thomas Sankara, but it indicates that French persons came to Burkina Faso to help Blaise Compaoré to clean things up.
Blaise Compaoré will soon become Paris's main guy in the region. The overthrow of Sankara in 1987 was not possible without the green light of Ivory Coast and the explicit support of Paris, in particular of Jacques Chirac, who was then Prime Minister. Chirac really disliked Thomas Sankara. Was France also complicit in the killing of Thomas Sankara? To answer that question, all the classified archives have to be opened.
The full opening of archives would allow to clarify the exact conditions of the putsch against Thomas Sankara. The judges in Burkina Faso were very surprised that no documents sent from France had the stamp classified military secret or top secret.
In 2017, French President Macron promised in Burkina Faso to declassify all the archives concerning the assassination of Thomas Sankara, but only diplomatic and other public documents have been sent. Experts suspect that French military might prevent the opening of all the archives because that could reveal the truth about Operation Barkhane. France is more and more criticized in Mali, and the anti-French sentiment in Burkina Faso is also growing. Chris Den Hond, Paris.
United States President Joe Biden has made a deal with Mexico, Guatemala, and Honduras to increase border security in order to prevent refugees from reaching the U.S. border. The leaders of Mexico and Guatemala criticized Biden for having initially sent compassionate messages that encouraged refugees to try and reunite with their families, only to find often brutal conditions and deplorable treatment at the U.S. border. Per capita, the U.S. accepts only a tiny amount of asylum seekers, and yet immigration appears to be the most talked about issue today. What's seemingly never discussed in the mainstream media is how U.S. foreign policy is so often the direct cause of the political instability and economic dysfunction which produces these regular refugee crises.
It feels odd to say even foreign policy, considering how deeply involved the U.S. has been in the development of Latin America, especially Central America, where a lot of these, you know, refugees and migrants are coming from. And this, you know, 100-year-long history is never addressed in the media. The wars in the 80s that Reagan waged against, you know, progressive governments and movements in Central America are never discussed. And even, like, extremely recent history, like the 2008 overthrow of the government in Honduras or the disputed 2017 election, are not discussed. And that is just recent history. It doesn't delve into, you know, the long history of colonialism, the Monroe Doctrine. People may have heard this in school, but they don't really understand what it means. It means the U.S. extracting resources from these countries. So it's no wonder that people would want to go from the areas the U.S. impoverished to the U.S., which has that wealth now.
Domestically, Republicans are being accused of fear-mongering about immigrants, while Democrats are being accused of using foreign immigration to distract from the unprecedented economic and health crises. The right to asylum is protected in international and U.S. law, but Biden appears to be following the same militaristic approach as his controversial predecessor, which many repeatedly called inhumane. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Young black people have been hardest hit by unemployment during the pandemic, new research indicates. Over the past year, the UK jobless rate for young black people rose by more than a third to 35%, according to the Resolution Foundation think tank. That compared with a rate of 13% for young white people and a rate of 24% for young people of Asian descent. By the end of the year, unemployment among young black graduates had risen to 34%, up from 22% before the pandemic.
I graduated last year with a business degree, and I know COVID has, you know, really impacted the job market and all that stuff. But just being a black person as well, on top of that, it just makes things a lot harder.
Even if a black person has a degree and has just left university, they're finding it hugely difficult to get a job. And I think that's proof positive that Britain is a systemically racist society. Even in the year of 2021, we're seeing that time and time again, that the life chances, the opportunities available to black people are much worse than those available to the white population.
The findings follow the government's recent controversial report into race relations in British society, which claimed the UK does not suffer from institutional racism and should be a model for other white majority nations. Yet the research from the Resolution Foundation, along with other racial disparity statistics, paints a very different picture, which critics argue the government's report failed to acknowledge.
In the British capital, London, young black males were 19 times more likely to be stopped and searched than the general population, and were 28 times more likely to be stopped on suspicion of carrying weapons than the general population. Black people were 6.5 times more likely to be fined than white people for breaking COVID-19 regulations, and more than 4 times more likely to die from COVID-19 than white people.
Black Britons, African Caribbeans and Asians face systemic racism. They're 9 times more likely to be stopped and searched by the police. As women, 3 times more likely to die in childbirth. Were 60% of the doctors and nurses and health frontline workers who died at the very beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic. And for the government's report to say that institutional racism doesn't exist is just a kick in the teeth.
Foundation's findings expose that COVID had widened already existing gaps between the UK's ethnic groups, and they've urged for special efforts to ensure that young people from hard-hit ethnic backgrounds had access to quality education, training options, and where needed, financial support for full-time study. But many will feel the government may not have the remedy for this issue while they refuse to accept the diagnosis, systemic racism. Ahmed Kabbalah, London.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on RIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. As you know, this is the blessed month of Ramadan. We're in the month of Ramadan. The month of Ramadan is a very sacred and holy month in the Islamic calendar. One of the distinctions of the month of Ramadan is that the month of Ramadan is the only month where fasting is obligatory on human beings. And the question that we want to ask today is this. A lot of people ask this question: why should we fast? Or what's the reason why we fast? Why has God made this obligatory upon us in this month? With the reservation that human beings don't really know the real causes and real reasons behind the obligations and prohibitions that God has set out in Islamic law. But nevertheless, we have been made aware of some of the wisdom and benefits of these acts through the Hadith and the Quran. Today we're going to be looking at some of those and examining them in the light of the traditions of the family of the Prophet alayhi salam. In a blessed tradition from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, the Imam is reported to have said that God made the fast obligatory upon human beings so that in this way the poor and the rich would be made equal. And this is one of the benefits of fasting. When we fast and we stay hungry and we refrain from certain acts from the morning till the night, we feel a sense of equality with the poor who have been deprived even under normal situations from these blessings. Obviously, this is a prelude to the elimination and the eradication of poverty. Once we feel this affinity with the poor, we should take steps to rectify their poverty and eliminate it from society. This is one of the reasons why we fast. Another reason which has been mentioned in the traditions is that fasting is a test to see the sincerity and weigh the sincerity of the believers and the Muslims. فَرَضَ اللَّهُ الصِّيَامَ ابْتِلَاءً لِإِخْلَاصِ الْخَلْقِ. Imam Ali alayhi salam has been reported to have said that God Almighty made the fast obligatory upon human beings so that he could test their sincerity, so he could test the sincerity of creatures. Everybody says, we believe in God, we have faith in him. Right? But how do we know that we really have faith in him, or we're just saying it with our tongues, verbally? In order to test this, our faith, God Almighty has made the fast obligatory upon us. This is one of the tests. Obviously, there's other tests as well. Another wisdom or reason why the fast has been made obligatory upon us is so that human beings remember the hunger and thirst that they will experience on the day of resurrection. In a blessed tradition from Imam Reza alayhi salam, the Imam is reported to have said that God commanded people, or the people have been commanded to fast, so that they would know the pain of hunger and thirst, so that that they could remind themselves in this way of their impoverishment on the day of resurrection and the hereafter. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were examining some of the reasons for fasting. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Just 7 hours before prosecutors opened their case against Derek Chauvin, a former Minneapolis police officer charged with murdering George Floyd, a Chicago police officer chased down a 13-year-old teenage boy in a West Side alley and fatally shot him as he turned with his hands up. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist John Elligon and Sean Hoovler. The piece is titled, Throughout Trial Over George Floyd's Death, Killings by Police Mount. Just 7 hours before prosecutors opened their case against Derek Chauvin, a former Minneapolis police officer charged with murdering George Floyd, a Chicago police officer chased down a 13-year-old teenage boy in a West Side alley and fatally shot him as he turned with his hands up. One day later, at a hotel in Jacksonville, Florida, police officers fatally shot a 32-year-old man who the police say grabbed one of their tasers. The day after that, as an eyewitness to Mr. Floyd's death broke down in a Minneapolis courtroom while recounting what he saw, a 40-year-old mentally ill man who said he was being harassed by voices was killed in Claremont, New Hampshire, in a shootout with the state police. On every day that followed, all the way through the close of testimony, another person was killed by the police somewhere in the United States. The trial has forced a traumatized country to relive the gruesome death of George Floyd beneath Derek Chauvin's knee. But even as Americans continue to process that case and anxiously wait for a verdict, new cases of people killed by the police mount unabated. Since testimony began on 29th of March, at least 64 people have died at the hands of law enforcement nationwide, with black and Latino people representing more than half of the dead. As of Saturday, the average was more than 3 killings a day. The deaths, culled by the New York Times from gun violence databases, new media accounts and law enforcement releases, offer a snapshot of policing in America at this moment. They testify not only to the danger and desperation that police officers confront daily, but also to the split-second choices and missteps by members of law enforcement that can escalate workaday arrests into fatalities. They are the result of domestic violence calls, traffic stops gone awry, standoffs and chases. The victims often behave erratically, some suffering from mental illness, and the sight of anything resembling a weapon causes things to escalate very quickly. And their fallout has been wrenchingly familiar, from the graphic videos that so often emerge to the protests that so often descend into scuffles between law enforcement and demonstrators on the streets of the United States, filled with tear gas. Just as one community confronts one killing, another killing happens. Across the spectrum, from community activists to law enforcement personnel, there is emotional and mental exhaustion, and a feeling that the nation cannot get this right. How many more losses must be mourned? Miski Noor, the co-executive director of the Minneapolis-based activist group Black Visions, said in a statement after the killing of Daunte Wright, a 20-year-old, during a recent traffic stop in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota. "The pain of George Floyd's death is still scarred into our minds, and yet history continues to repeat itself," the statement continued. "Our community has reached its breaking point." This past week, the mayor of Chicago called for calm as excruciating body camera footage was released in the police killing of a 13-year-old teenager, Adam Toledo. The shaky video shows a police officer responding to a call of shots fired, chasing a boy with what appears to be a gun down an alley at night in a predominantly Latino neighborhood. "Stop right now," the police officer screams whilst cursing. "Hands, show me your hands, drop it, drop it." A single shot fells the boy as he turns, lifting his hands. Other recent lethal force incidents have rocked communities large and small. Michael Leon Hughes, a 32-year-old, a black man shot to death on 30th of March after the police said he used a taser on a Jacksonville police officer responding to a domestic dispute in a motel. I remember Cycap, a 16-year-old, a Pacific Islander, killed on 5th of April as he fled from the Honolulu police in a stolen Honda Civic. And Anthony Thompson Jr., a 17-year-old black teenager in Knoxville, Tennessee, killed by police on 12th of April in a high school bathroom after reports that a student had brought a gun onto the campus. All of those killings and many more occurred as testimony in the Minneapolis trial unfolded, though few attracted as much national attention as the shooting of Daunte Wright, less than 10 miles from the courthouse where Derek Chauvin stood trial. Protests erupted in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, after a veteran police officer fatally shot Daunte Wright, saying she mistook her gun for her taser as he attempted to flee during a traffic stop. Abigail Serra, a Minneapolis civil rights lawyer and member of the Minneapolis Police Conduct Oversight Commission, said it was unclear why the police officers stopped him for an expired registration, an issue for many drivers in the state during the coronavirus pandemic. But two aspects of the case, she said, were infuriatingly familiar: that Daunte Wright was black, and that the police tasked with delivering him safely to the courts of law, where violations of the law are supposed to be adjudicated, effectively delivered a death sentence. "It's just another example of a nothing offense escalated to lethality," Ms. Serra said. Though many of these killings have a familiar ring, it is unfair to blame them all on law enforcement, said Patrick Yose, a retired sheriff's office captain and president of the National Fraternal Order of Police. "In a lot of cities, it has to do with people feeling hopeless," he said. it's poverty, it's a failing education system. It's all of these things that are vitally important to stability of a community. That instability often places police officers in situations in which they confront individuals who may be dangerous and non-compliant, he said. Part of the reason society has been unable to prevent deadly encounters between law enforcement and the community is that some people are unwilling to discuss the real challenges of crime that police officers sometimes encounter, he said. There's just so many factors that people have already made up their minds, and they think that law enforcement is based off of race, Mr. Yost continued. Federal and state laws generally hold that police officers are justified in using lethal force as long as they have a reasonable fear of imminent injury or death for themselves or another person. And jurors tend not to second-guess what might be reasonable force in the moment. Of the 64 fatal encounters compiled by the New York Times for the past 3 weeks, at least 42 cases involve people accused of wielding firearms. More than a dozen involve confrontations with people who were mentally ill or in the throes of a breakdown. And at least 10 cases arose as the police responded to reports of domestic violence. Since at least 2013, with a slight dip because of the coronavirus pandemic, about 1,100 people have been killed each year by police officers, according to databases compiled by Mapping Police Violence, a research and advocacy group that examines all such killings, including non-gun related deaths such as George Floyd's. The Washington Post, whose numbers are limited to police shootings, reflect a similarly flat trend line. Nearly all of the victims since 29th of March this year have been men, with black or Latino people substantially overrepresented, a pattern that reflects broader criminal justice research. And most were under the age of 30. Four were teenagers. Philip Stinson, a professor in the criminal justice program at Bowling Green State University, who studies civilian killings by members of law enforcement, said the most striking aspect of the statistics on lethal police force is how little the numbers have changed over the last decade or two, since researchers began to comprehensively track them. Dr. Philip Stinson added, "Even as cell phone videos and body cameras make it harder to hide human error and abuses of authority by law enforcement, and even as social media amplifies public outrage, only about 1.1% of police officers who kill civilians are actually charged with murder or manslaughter."
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Salaamu Alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems and questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. I'm Hassanain, and we have in the studio our guest speaker, Sheikh Farman Ali Ma'asoumi. He's an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya Qom. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program, Brother Farman.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
How are you, brother?
Thank you so much for inviting me and for giving me this great opportunity. And I would like to thank the IRIB English Radio for giving me this great opportunity.
So in this program, we'll look on to different ways how the parents can control their children. So Sheikh Farman, please continue.
We were talking about how we should advise our children.
Yeah.
So Quran and Islamic teachings say that we should do indirect advice to our children, especially teenagers. When we spoke in our last episode that Quran also says, emphasize on this way of advising people indirectly.
True, yeah, that's right.
Maybe this question will raise in your mind that so while there are a lot of, you know, direct advisors we have in the Holy Quran, in Hadith, in, you know, in, for example, Hazrat Luqman, you know, advising his son in the Holy Quran.
Yeah, right.
The answer is, whenever you feel that your listener is ready to give whatever you are saying, there you should do advice directly.
Okay, so
for example, our imams, whenever they would go to preach, to tell, you know, teach the people, they would do directly, advise them. Yeah, because there was the situation was like this, everybody was ready to take whatever imam would say. But we are talking about teenagers. They are not ready to take whatever you say, whatever advice you give. So in these situations, we should do indirect.
So when we know that the listener will accept it and act upon it, so that it can be direct.
Yeah, like in our Holy Prophet's whole life, you can see he has done a lot of indirect, you know, tabligh also.
True.
And
yeah.
wherever there people are ready, he will do directly tabligh or advises. So we are emphasizing on this, that we should do indirectly advise our teenagers mostly. And sometimes directly we can do, but in a very polite way.
Yeah, that's right.
Let me give some examples, you know, how we can do advise our children, teenagers, indirectly. For example, your teenager son spends a lot of time playing games, internet games, online games.
Many parents face this problem.
So, for example, you want to say something that this is not good for your health. So, you go purchase a book. About this, you know, for example, if he reads books, again, it goes to your tarbiyah. If it is your habit to give him books, so now also you can purchase a book and give him. Then when he studies the book, he can understand. But if this wasn't part of your daily routine, you would not give any book.
He won't be interested in reading the book.
So if you purchase a book, he will understand that you have purchased this book specially. So it would become a direct advice, which will not have any impact.
True.
So always our indirect advice should be in such a way that it remains indirect. Our teenager does not understand that we want to advise him.
True.
Then it can be beneficial and effective. Otherwise, it can have, you know, reactions also. If he understands that you want to advise him, then maybe he will become more rebel.
Thank you so much, Sheikh Farman. Let's take a short break over here, and dear audience, we'll be right back after the break.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back to your audience, and before the break, we were discussing about the direct and the indirect way of advising. So, Sheikh Farman, do you have any more points to add to it?
Yeah, alhamdulillah, our riwayat, our imams, Imam Ma'sumin alayhim as-salam, and the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam have left us such a big and very important treasure in the form of riwayat, which have a lot of benefit for us. So in riwayat and in the life of our Ma'sumin alayhi as-salam, we can find so many rules that how to behave and treat our teenagers, you know, indirectly how we can advise. So there are some very important rules. I will quickly list-wise mention. Inshallah, our listeners can note it down and they can use in their practical life. Regarding our teenagers, the first and very important rule is we have to be open-minded. As I said, we should not use our mindset. You know, in the atmosphere where we have been brought up, and our fathers and our parents, they have brought up us, we should leave that mindset. And we should be open-minded. Because there is a big gap between us and our children, teenagers.
Yeah, you know, there's a time difference.
Time difference. Technology has advanced a lot. So many, many differences.
Right. Yeah,
you know, so we cannot keep all the things which we have brought in our society in mind, and according to that, we advise our teenagers. No, it is completely wrong.
True.
Our imams also, they have said that your age is different.
From the your
era is completely different, and your children's era is completely different.
Yeah, that's right.
So this we should keep in our mind, and we should be open-minded. When your teenager understands that you are open-minded, then he can come close to you.
True.
Yeah. Then this gap can be reduced slowly, slowly. This is a very, very difficult. Because, for example, a father in his 40s and 50s, you know, for 40, 35 years, he has been in our atmosphere. But no matter whatever struggle it needs, we should struggle and we should bring this change in our mind and use an open mind to discuss with your teenagers.
That's right. So let's take a short break over here and we'll continue after the break.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, He who has a child must treat him in a childish manner.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
Welcome back to your audience, and before the break we were discussing about the different ways of advising the children. So one of them we said is the parents need to be open-minded. And proceeding with this next one, I'd like Sheikh Farman to continue.
Second rule regarding advising your teenagers is you keep yourself in his place. This is very important again. You suppose that you are a teenager and you think that how you want your parents to behave you. According to that, you behave with your teenager. This is, again, very difficult, but very useful. If you use yourself, you will see totally difference between your thoughts, your mindset, and the needs and requirements of your teenager.
That's right.
So this can help you to better understand your teenager. And number three is to be a very good listener. This is very, very important again. I think the most important thing is to be a good listener.
To the children.
To the children. As you know, that our Rasulullah, according to Quran, he was khayru udhun. You know? He would listen to his companions. He would listen to the people as if, you know, completely he was focusing on the person who was talking to him.
Yeah, so he was the best listener.
Yeah, best listener. Yeah. That's what Quran says, khayru udhun. Best ear.
Indeed,
Yeah. when the person you're talking to him or he's talking to you, he understands you are listening mm-hmm. carefully, this solves the half of problem.
That's right, yeah.
To be
so
a good
like
listener.
So it's like respecting your listener.
Respecting your listener. And unfortunately, in our families, especially mm-hmm. between husband and wife or children and parents, this is lacking nowadays.
Unfortunately, yeah.
Because while talking, he's thinking about something else.
True.
Yeah, he's watching TV or playing with his mobile.
Yeah, it's, disrespectful to the person who's talking.
Disrespectful, and you cannot understand whatever he's saying completely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So being a very, very good listener to your children solves half of the problems. Riwayat also, even the Western, you know, psychologists or the experts, they say, they have written a lot of books also, that if you become a good listener to your children, uh-huh. especially to your teenagers, they will become, in return, a yeah. very good listener.
Mm-hmm.
The main problem is listening to each other.
That's right. Yeah.
Even personally, I have seen, I was in this corona time, yeah. I had discussion, yeah, with a couple, mm-hmm. they had problems with each uh-huh. other, you know. They were married for 10 years, but for some problems, they were separated.
Uh-huh.
So I talked first to the husband, then mm-hmm. the wife,
yeah.
and I noted all the differences, all the, you know, disputes between
yeah.
them. And then I said to husband, first carefully listen whatever she complains
yeah.
over the Zoom meeting, yeah?
yeah?
Then she started saying all the problems. Then after she finished,
yeah.
I said to her to listen carefully whatever her husband says.
Mm-hmm.
Then again, husband started speaking all the problems they
mm-hmm.
had between.
Yeah.
When they understood the each other's,
yeah.
you know,
problems.
Disputes and problems.
Yeah.
After that, there was, I think, very less
mm-hmm.
disputes
yeah.
between them.
Yeah, true.
The main problem was they were now listening to each other. So if you are a good listener to your children, to your teenagers, they will become very, very good listener to you.
Inshallah. So thank you so much, Sheikh Farman. And thank you so much, our dear good listeners who are listening to us. So in this program, we have discussed about the indirect and the direct ways of advising to our children. We said some of the ways that we can provide them with the books so that we can convey our message to them through the books. And we have also discussed different riwayat, in which one of them is like, we need to be open-minded. So we said that because there's a time difference between children and their parents, so we need to be open-minded. And we also said that parents need to keep themselves in the place of their children so that they can understand what they want and what they don't. And the last thing we said is the parents need to be a good listener to their children so that children, they feel respected. So through this, half of the problems are solved. If you have any questions, comments or suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir, and visit us at our website, parstoday.com. Until the next program, fi amanullah.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is the way of life. A complete way, it's a complete way.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BATR 5, and via Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.